Good afternoon. I can see the auditorium is full, and I think that's absolutely appropriate given the stature of the speaker that we have invited today for the Wednesday afternoon lecture. Dr. Janisch has been a leading figure in research to understand molecular mechanisms that underlie programming, deprogramming, and reprogramming of mammalian cells. And these, I think we would all agree, represent some of the most fundamental and key questions in cell biology today. I was reading his CV earlier, and his honors are far too numerous to comprehensively review at this time, but they do include membership in the National Academy of Sciences. He's been an extremely productive member of the Whitehead Institute for Biomedical Research and professor of biology at MIT since 1984. And during this time, he and his laboratory have made very significant original contributions in areas that range from carcinogenesis, epigenetic regulation, into normal development. The title of his talk is Stem Cells, Pluripotency, and Nuclear Reprogramming, and I'm very much looking forward to what he has to say today. Rudy.
Okay, thank you very much, Jim, for the introduction and for the invitation to give this lecture. So, let me just start with just defining the issue. So we have one genome. Once we know the sequence of one cell, we then know the sequence of all cells, obviously. But genes are packaged into proteins, and we have many, many epigenomes. And so the issue is, what's the difference between cell A and cell B and cell C, or between a stem cell and a differentiated cell? And we want to explain this in explaining, obviously, the epigenetic state of the cells, and we would like to understand to a degree where we can convert one cell type to the other. So programming and reprogramming, so programming is a very important process of development. An embryonic cell becomes an adult cell by nothing else by changing its epigenetic state. Similarly, an adult stem cell becomes a terminally differentiated cell by changing its epigenetic state. A normal cell can become a cancer cell by largely changing its epigenetic state. We are pretty sure about these statements because we can reverse it. We can make out of a mammary gland cell Dolly by nuclear transfer. We can take terminally differentiated lymphocytes or neurons and generate an embryonic stem cell and animals. And we even can reprogram certain cancers to generate multi-pluripotent cells, arguing that this particular cancer, in this case a melanoma, was largely, its phenotype largely determined by epigenetic, that is, reversible changes. So obviously the interest is to in embryonic pluripotent cells. And so you can ask, what is the final goal of stem cell research? And I think using the potential of ES cells to provide eventually matched cells for customized tissue repair to degenerative diseases. So this is a far away goal, but I think we come closer now slowly. So you could argue the induction of pluripotency and the quest for eternal youth is a very old question of humankind. And Lucas Cranach, 500 years ago, envisaged that old and sick people get into this pool of the spawn of youth and arise on the other side as refreshed and rejuvenated. And surely Lucas Cranach had in mind a pool of stem cells here. So where are we there? I think clearly there are limitations in embryonic stem cells. And the limitations are that embryonic stem cells, in the case of human, are from donated embryos, so they will always be rejected. And so the potential solution, of course, was nuclear transplantation to generate customized ES cells with all its objections, ethical problems, political issues, as you're all well aware of. So just to make this point, embryonic stem cells are derived from sexually reproduced embryos. They can generate therapeutic tissues, but when introduced into a patient, they will be invariably rejected. And the promise of nuclear transplantation was you derive the cells by somatic cell nuclear transfer, and you generate customized therapeutic tissue, and of course, this tissue will not be rejected when used for therapy. And a number of years ago, we made a proof of principle experiment by using, as a patient, if you want, a immune deficient mouse, a RAC2 mutation, which has no B and T cells, and in two steps, In the first step, they were generated by nuclear transfer cloned blastocysts and then cloned YES cells. Gene targeting was used to correct one of the two alleles. And the second step then, together with George Daly, was to generate in vitro hematopoietic stem cells. And when introduced into the animal, they indeed restore the immune system. So that was a proof of principle experiment that this would work. And we could argue this could be used in humans for diseases of the bone marrow, like thalassemia, sickle cell anemia, and so on. But there were obviously problems with this approach. The problems are it's much too inefficient. Actually, it hasn't been shown in humans to work at all. It certainly would be too costly for routine treatment, and there were major objections. So what were the options here? And I think everybody agreed there was really one realistic option here, and this was to achieve reprogramming without human eggs. So what we had to understand was what are the reprogramming rules that the egg uses? And in a way, we could be reassured it's not a miracle. It looks like a miracle, but it's not a miracle. It's a biochemical reaction. So in principle, one should be able to understand this. So there were two complementing strategies to induce reprogramming in vitro. And they were used by many laboratories, including ours. One was to understand what's the molecular circuitry of a pluripotent embryonic stem cell. So what distinguishes a pluripotent from a committed from a differentiated cell? And the second one was to use some factors which come out of these type of approaches to force expression in the somatic cells. So let me briefly summarize the first approach with a few slides and then come to the second one. So what we want to understand is what determines self-renewal of a pluripotent embryonic stem cell and what controls differentiation. Basic questions, and many laboratories have contributed to this, and I give you just a very simple summary. There are three, and you will hear more about, three key transcription factors, OCT4, NOC, and SOX2. And these factors, we know from many genetic experiments, are key for maintaining pluripotency and to make an embryo to develop. And they have two functions. They work as activators of genes, so they're co-localized with polymerase II, of genes which are active in embryonic stem cells. And in general, these are genes which are important for proliferation. And they act as repressors in combination with polycomb proteins to repress developmental regulators. Those would be the developmental regulators developmental biologists are interested in, like the HOX genes, the PUX genes, the MYOD genes, what have you. They need to be silent in embryonic stem cells, but they get activated when these cells are induced to differentiate. There's another very important aspect, which I will use later in my talk, that these three factors interact with each other. They form an autoregulatory loop. So OCT4 interacts with SOX2, NANOC, and with itself, and the others do the same. It is thought that this autoregulation is important for adjusting the level, which has to be accurate. It has to be in a certain level to assure pluripotency to a certain level. For example, if you have too much OCT4, you differentiate into one lineage. If you have too little, into another. But you can't maintain pluripotency. I will come back to this. So what we then have is these three factors are important to stimulate genes, which are important for self-renewal, and they inhibit genes together with the polycombs, which would induce differentiation. So is this understanding useful for reprogramming? And of course, you all know that a year ago, Yamanaka's group did this experiment where they inserted a neogene into this downstream OCT4 gene, FBX15, and of course, these fibroblasts carrying this gene were sensitive to the drug because the gene is off. But then he introduced these four factors, OCT4, SOX2, and two oncogenes, Simerk and KLO4, and he could select these neoresistant cells, which he called iPS cells, induced pluripotent cells. They were clearly pluripotent, but they were not ES cells. They would kill a chimeric embryo, and they were really very different from ES cells. So in further experiments later by our group, by Konrad Ehlinger's group, and by Yamanaka's group last year, using the upstream genes as a marker, so using OCT4-NEO or NANOC-NEO insertions, then we could generate OCT4-IPS and NANOC-IPSs, and they were truly pluripotent. So I will not talk much about it. I will make two points about these published data. So just make the point here. These are normal YES cells growing on a feeder layer. This would be OCT4 iPS cells or NANOC iPS cells. And when you look at markers, they express alkaline phosphatase, SSA1, another marker which I will use later, and the activated NANOC, which was not among the four factors introduced. So what I want to briefly say is, what is the kinetics of these factor appearance? And just a brief characterization, and then come to all new data. So the appearance, that's an important point. The appearance of near-resistant colonies marking the activation of, let's say, NANOC or OCT4 is gradually. And this will be important. So in the original Yamanaka experiments and also in our experiments, you infect cells at day zero, and at day five you find the first near-resistant colonies appearing. And then after 2 weeks, there are many more. And the markers appear also gradually. So at 2 weeks, after 2 weeks, you see alkaline phosphatase and SSA1B expressed. There's no NANOC yet. But at 3 weeks after infection, you see NANOC cells coming up, and those would be iPS cells, and there are many more which are alkaline phosphatase positive. So the conclusion is, reprogramming is a gradual process, and the pluripotency markers appear sequentially. And I want to come back to this. The neoresistant marker appears rather early. It will be important for what I'm going to tell you later. Of course, important is, are these cells now really pluripotent? And you can look at gene expression profiles, and I just want to go into any details here, but if you compare different MEFs, donors or control MEFs, they're clustered together, and iPS and ES cells cluster together. So by gene expression, they're identical. And if you look at the endogenous OCT4 NANOC genes, then by methylation, they're, of course, unmethylated in ES cells because they're expressed. They're highly silenced and methylated in fibroblasts, but they're totally demethylated in those cells. Really a very strong argument that the endogenous genes are activated. The viruses actually get inactivated, and I will come not really to this, but I will point it out already. So are these really pluripotent cells? And the key criterion, of course, can they make mice? And they can. They can make nice chimeras, and they can contribute to the germline. So this is, everybody agrees on this. These three papers last year from our group, from Konrad Hochedlinger's group, and from Yamanaka's group agree totally the complementary studies. So I think surely this is a fact and has been repeated now. So if I summarize all these data, then it's sort of amazing. You have cells growing in a petri dish, fibroblasts. You take a single cell, transduce these factors, and you get a mouse. Now, this mouse is not a chimera. This is a mouse generated by tetraploid complementation. This is a trick which I'm not going into, but it's a trick where no blastocyst, host blastocyst-derived cells contribute to the embryo. So this mouse is only constructed from these cells, which originally in the petri dish. So that can be induced to construct a brain, eyes, limbs, and the liver, and so on and so forth. Pretty amazing. So a single skin cell can give rise to full embryo upon transduction with these four factors. So if you think about the mechanism, and that's really what I want to talk about now. So we know by sure in the infected cells, the virally transduced genes are very highly expressed with a viral LTR. The endogenous genes are either totally off or low expressed. And in the reprogrammed cells, we know that these genes are really highly expressed, like normal YES cells, and the viruses are shut off. So the maintenance of the pluripotent state depends on the activity of those genes, on this autoregulatory loop which I mentioned, which I will come back to. So what happens in between? So this is the black box of reprogramming. So what do we know? So we know this goes down and this goes up. And we probably understand quite well the silencing of the viruses, because during the reprogramming process, the silent de novo methyltransferases, 3A and 3B, become activated. And what I know for 30 years that I started my career is viruses, LTR, are terrific targets for de novo methylation. So it's sort of a self-inactivating system. They're highly expressed in these cells which do not express these enzymes. They get activated during the process, and then they inactivate the virus, and then, therefore, the pluripotent state depends on the endogenous genes. But we would like to know what is the kinetics of this. Why is the process inefficient? Are there stochastic events involved? Is there insertion mutagenesis, activation of oncogenes? Are there alternative factors? Is there a sequence of a specific activation of these markers, or are there precursors which we can define? What's the minimal time of expression of these factors? You couldn't study in this because it was self-inactivating. So we need a different approach. And what about differentiated cells? What is a target cell? Is it a somatic stem cell, or is it a differentiated cell? So I'm going to address all these issues here. So first, let me remind you, when you infect fibroblasts with these viruses and ask the question, how many copies are carried, proviral copies are carried in the iPS cells? It's a lot. So you infect maybe with one copy per cell in the average, but you end up iPS cells carrying 15 to more proviruses. There's selection for high copy number, which of course is very important, which so argue selection for high, is it due to you need high levels of expression while you get these rare cells which have so many copies integrated? Is it a stoichiometry? Is it activation of an oncogene by insertional mutagenesis? That's a hallmark, of course, of insertional mutagenesis. Or there are stochastic epigenetic events. So let me come to this later point here. What we did was to, and I'm not going to show you the data, just give you the summary. So if this is a population of fibroblasts which get infected with these factors, and they carry a GFP in the OCT4 locus or a GFP in the NANOC locus to mark, to detect reprogramming. So you can infect those, and at day 6, you clearly see that the cells change their morphology. They look like transformed cells. And you can grow them, and you can now subclone one of those, right? So when you subclone those and now culture them as sibling cells, what you find is GFP gets turned on in one early, in another one later, and in others maybe never. Now we know from southern blots, they're absolute sibling cells because they have the same integration pattern. So they're sibling cells, but they turn on, they become iPS cells at a very different individual schedule. Some early, some never. So the conclusion is very clearly, reprogramming involves subsequent many stochastic events, epigenetic events. It's not a switch you turn. I will come back to this issue. So reprogram is inefficient and involves stochastic epigenetic events. Is there a specific sequence of pluripotency marker activation? And how long do need these factors be expressed? That's a very important issue if you want to think about alternatives to viruses to induce reprogramming, like protein transduction or something. You want to know how long do we need virus expression. So we had to manipulate this. So with this, what we generated was a dox-inducible antivirus system. In this case, we use cells which carry a GFP marker in the NANOC or the LOC or the OCT4 locus, so they would be GFP negative. And we then infect them with a virus which has a tetracycline responsible element, and the cells also carry the transactivator. We infect them, we induce them, and then we can just monitor the marker activation and, of course, now OCT4 or NANOC activation by looking at GFP. And the system works quite well. My computer. So we can get these cells, and if you take doxycycline away, you can make chimeras, and they go to the germline. So clearly, we can make iPS cells this way. So now we can use a system. And what is the kinetic of these marker appearance, which I alluded before? And so what you do is you take this ES cell control, and now you give doxycycline, and you monitor alkaline phosphatase at different days after induction in either the OCT4 GFP or the NANOC GFP. And you can see early, at day three, there's very few cells express alkaline phosphatase. It goes up, and then many, 70 to 80%, as I showed you before, express alkaline phosphatase. That's the least stringent marker. If you look now, sort for SSE1 versus GFP, then you find that at day 9, you find clearly GFP, SSA1 positive cells, but no GFP positive cells, none. At day 12, there are more SSA1 positive cells, still no GFP positive cells. You see the first GFP positive cells, so these are the truly iPS cells, coming at more than 2 weeks after induction, and then you get more at a later stage. So when you put this more quantitatively here, then it's important to show that you get AP very early, SSA1 a little later, and the first NANOC OCT4 positive cells, very few, come up at day 16 in this kinetic, and then you get a few more later. So the question is there a precursor product relationship between these different markers and the iPS cells. So does SE1 mark an intermediate stage? And so what we did was to take cells, sort cells, at day 16 after doxycycline and take the SE1 positive GFP negative cells, sort them out, and then culture them either without dox or with dox. And in both cases, you find they make iPS cells. But with doxycycline, they make tenfold more. But the point is, if you take these cells at day 16, even without dox, they are an autopilot. Some of those can make an iPS cell. If you do the same experiment earlier, at nine days, and you take again the same phenotype of cells, SA1 positive, GFP negative cells, and culture them plus minus dox, you find that plus dox, you do get, as you can see here, some GFP positive cells, with minus never. Actually, these cells, which are at this stage morphologically already different, they totally revert back to the fibroblast stage. So the conclusion then is, at early days, 9 days after induction, these cells are unstable in the absence of further expression of these factors, and they revert back to the fibroblast-like state. But a week later, day 16, the same phenotype of cells are poised to become, at least some of them, poised to become iPS cells, even in the absence of doxycycline. So now, the minimum time of vector expression, that's of course is important. And for this, what we did was using the system to induce at day zero, and then withdraw doxycycline at different times and analyze at 35 days after doxycycline. So they all get analyzed at the same time, but they were exposed to different times to doxycycline. And then we asked, who is alkaline phosphatase positive? And what you see is that although at day 12 at this point, many cells would be alkaline phosphatase positive. If you withdraw doxycycline at 35 days, none of them is anymore. They all turn off alkaline phosphatase. You can see only after 2 weeks you see a few. And then you see many more if you leave doxycycline longer in. And if you look for SSA1 or for GFP in this case, you can see that you really find, if you withdraw doxycycline, only for 14 days you see the first GFP colonies then appearing at 35 days. So withdrawing before 12 days, this was just one colony, I'm not sure if that's right, you really don't find iPS cells. So which argues then that the vector needs to express for more than 12 days to generate iPS cells. Now this then would be the period which you have to think about to supply, if you want to make it, reprogram cells by non-genetic means. That's the time period you want to supply these factors by whatever means you want to do. Transient transfection, non-integrating viruses, protein transfection, whatever the means is. But this gives you a time frame. That's why it was important for us. So if you think about the kinetics of reprogramming then, so we have this 1 month here. So you give doxycycline, and the first switch turns on are these markers, AP after 3 days, SSA1 at 9 days. But I told you before, OCT4 and NANOC resistant markers come on really at this early time. But if you look at GFP, that comes on much later, 2 weeks at earliest. These would be then cells which are really truly iPS cells. Those are not. And the minimum of expression of transgene is 12 days in our experiments. But of course it helps if you do it longer. So the point I want to make here is drug-resistant colonies appear much earlier than the GFP colonies. So the locus gets activated, but it's somewhat not an iPS cell. You want to explain that. And it's a sequential activation of these pluripotency markers, and the minimal vector expression is 12 days. So how do we put this all together? And so I'll give you a model which sort of reflects what we think. The epigenetic sequential steps. So when you infect fibroblasts with these viruses, then at the early stage, let's say 6 days, you clearly find a partially reprogrammed cell, which is SA1 positive, AP positive, and neoresistant, if that is what the markers you're looking for. Neoresistant has activated something in the OCT4 locus or NANOC locus. But they're not GFP positive. They become only GFP positive in the fully reprogrammed iPS cells. So it's sequential. So what's happening? So what we think is happening, and I didn't tell you this, but This locus, Oct4-SOX2-NANOC, the endogenous loci are highly methylated. I showed you this. And they're in a very restrictive K9 methylation histone configuration. So what we believe is the very first step, let's say to activate partially this locus, might be partial demethylation, partial remodeling, enough to make a very small amount of expression of Oct4 RNA in NEO, which is enough to give you a drug-resistant colony. But if you take now the vectors away, this would match, revert back. But if you do it longer, then eventually you totally demethylate the loci and you totally reprogram the chromatin. And what you then have is, finally, a cell which is totally dependent on this autoregulatory circuit, which I mentioned before. So what we believe is, since these interact with each other, of course, these viruses will try to interact with these closed loci. They probably cannot because they're in a very restrictive chromatin configuration. So our belief is doing cell division, replication. You open up this window, and you can maybe partially demethylate this loci. There's a little bit of interaction. And then if you have a Meloni-based vector, then you, on the autopilot, you inactivate the virus, and then the thing runs on itself. So this is sort of the idea we have, the sequential activation of these loci. So, of course, I said we have to learn how the egg does it. Did we learn how the egg does nuclear transfer, the reprogramming? Are there the same molecular mechanisms involved? I think very likely not. I just want to contrast a few. So the cell cycle, of course, in nuclear transfer, the cells have to be in G1 or G0, otherwise it doesn't work. In vitro reprogramming, really, they have to proliferate. That's very important, over weeks. The timing of reprogramming as activation of Oct4, in nuclear transfer, one cell division. Schoeller has shown that the two-cell cloned embryo already has expressed this Oct4 marker transgene. In vitro reprogramming, as I showed, it takes weeks. So it's really a totally different mechanism. But is it the same end result? It is. By all means, there's no difference between ES cells and these iPS cells. By everything we did, and I didn't go into any of this. So it's interesting. You start from very different sites. Nuclear transfer, very different mechanism in vitro, and you end up at the same place. So I think it's like a default pathway of somatic genome to pluripotency, regardless how the process is initiated. So you select for fast proliferating cells, they're kicked into the right direction with Oct4, and you end up with the same default state. That's how I think one way to think about this. So there are a couple of key questions now. For example, what is a target cell? And it was the old raging debate when Dolly was born. Was Dolly really generated from a terminally differentiated cell, a mammary gland cell, or from a somatic stem cell? And, of course, it could not be resolved in these experiments because there was no marker. So reprogramming efficiency of different donor cells. And Yamanaka just a few weeks ago published that he could generate iPS cells from liver cells. Of course, there was no marker. And he introduced the marker with a Cre. But this Cre was not a very good one. It was pretty widely, not only liver cells expressed, but also in other cells. So it was not totally decisive. And he had no marker for his epithelial cells. So it's a very difficult question to address. So we'll come back to this. And is this whole thing useful for therapies? Well, these are the two things I want to address. And, of course, there are a number of issues when you think about potential therapeutic applications, like the differentiation potential of EIPS cells. We use at the moment viral vectors, insertional mutagenesis, and oncogenes. And, of course, human cells pose a number of other issues. So let me come to the terminally differentiated cells. And I go back historically. We generated about 6 years ago a monoclonal mouse by nuclear transplantation. It was important. The question was, do terminally differentiated cells, can they be reprogrammed? And so we could use as a genetic marker for terminal differentiation the inherent rearrangements of the immunoglobulin gene or the T-cell receptor gene as an invariable and irreversible marker of terminal differentiation. So it allowed us retrospectively to decide what was a donor cell because the process was so ineffective. And I just show you one slide here which made the point. So this would be probing of southern blot for the GNH rearrangement. And you can see that, of course, in normal mice, this all is in the germline configuration. that these yes cells made, these cloned yes cells from the peripheral B cells, and it was a proof, had both germline alleles rearranged. This was a somatic copy. And the mice from this had all this rearrangement, all organs. This is an unambiguous proof. Indeed, they were derived from a mature B cells, which had been mature to generate an antibody. So, of course, we wanted to know, can you do this with iPS cells in vitro? And B-cell development is a really terrific system because all these stages in this one lineage are well-defined. And so we have the pro-B-cells, which have rearranged the heavy chain, DJ, and then later pro-B-cells, VH to DGH. We have the pre-B-cells, also well-defined by markers. And finally, we have the mature B-cells, which then have also the light chains rearrangement. So we can really define retrospectively what did we do? What was a donor cell? And that's what we wanted to use. Of course, it was a technical issue. I told you iPS cells carry 15 to 20 proviruses. And we were worried. How can we get so many proviruses in these cells? So that was a major issue. So we thought about something around. I will tell you what we came up with to get around this heterogeneous population of viral infected cells. So that was a potential strategy to use the doxid-usable viruses generate what we call now primary iPS cells, just as I showed you before. And these primary iPS cells were then injected into blastocysts to generate a primary S-cell-derived chimera. So, of course, these cells carry exactly the same viruses in every cell because they were selected once here with this 15 provirus or whatever that was. And then we took out of these mice, we cannot take bone marrow cells, fetal bone marrow cells, fibroblasts, whatever we want. We don't have to infect them again. We just have to culture them and then give doxycycline. So that's, you get around the infection. That was a holding. And then we can ask the question, if you analyze, you know, what if we get now, it's secondary. We call them secondary iPS cells, right? So the key is we start with the primary iPS cells, so we get a cloned line from this with the right viruses, and we really then can analyze. We don't have to worry anymore about viral integration. So does it work? It works quite nicely. So this would be these secondary chimera-derived cells. If you don't give doxycycline, they don't express any of these viral factors, but if you give doxycycline, these would be now cells derived from pro-B, pre-B, or mature B cells. They express very nicely, as well as the fibroblasts isolated from the same cells, from the same chimeras. So at least we can induce those. Lentiviruses don't get silenced, so that worked. That was then interesting. So then we asked the question, can we pre-program, reprogram pre- or pro-B cells? So again, these cells were induced with doxycycline. Then we isolated subsets of cells by markers. And when you look now, these would be now pro-B cells and pre-B cells, and look at alkaline phosphatase, surely enough, after 10 days or so, they turn on alkaline phosphatase, whereas nothing happened with the IgM, with the mature B cells. We couldn't get any of those. So we worked with those, and sure enough, they had exactly the right properties. So they had no rearrangements of the light chains, of course you wouldn't expect that, but they're rearrangements of, these are now nine different, we call them immature B iPS cells, immature B cell iPS cells, and they have all rearrangements of which you would expect for these stages of pre- or pro-B cells in the heavy chain loci. And they could make chimeras, and when you look in the chimeras and isolate the cells, they had the right rearrangements, and they could also went to the germline. So we program our B cells. We could get iPS cells from pro- and pre-B cells, and they were, by infecting with OCT46 these factors, they had the right rearrangements, and they generate chimeras, and they were truly pluripotent. But this did not work for mature B cells. We totally failed. So what is missing? As nothing, could be nothing magic to it. Well, there was an interesting paper from Thomas Graf a few years ago where he looked at reprogram of B cells, look at major markers here. And there's one transcription factor, which of course caught our eye and his. This is CEBP-alpha. That is the CAT enhancer binding protein, which inhibits PAX5 actually. And he could show that when he expresses this force expressed in B cells, he could generate macrophages from those. So What we thought was maybe these cells, when we put these factors on these mature B cells, they begin to proliferate quite well, but they really were not, they got stuck in proliferation. So we changed the strategy. The strategy was then to get this, again, the primary iPS lines carrying the DOX-inducible viruses, generate a chimera, as I said before, isolate now mature B and T cells, and now grow these cells in cytokines to induce proliferation, plus some B lineage-specific genes, whatever we had. And then after a while, switch them to ESL, medium, and doxycycline, and see, can we get no iPS lines? And it worked. So you can see a number of factors. We never got anything, but with CBB-alpha and some IL-7, we clearly got alkaline phosphatase cells, or phosphatase-positive cells, and it was a certain kinetics. So day one and day four, they really look pretty crappy, it's like transformed cells, and they grow. At day eight, nothing special. There's certainly these had NANOC GFP, and there was no NANOC expression at day 11, but at day 15, bang, there were cells which were NANOC GFP positive. So that looked good. And so then we analyzed these cells, and I'm not going to go into this much, but they had all the expected rearrangements. So these would be nine different, now call them BIPS cells, for mature BIPS cells. They had rearrangements of the light change, either kappa or lambda, and they have unproductive rearrangements or productive rearrangements, as you would expect. And they have, of course, all rearrangement in the heavy chain locus. And they even had actually somatic hypermutations. So they were really B cells which had been engaged in some meeting some antigens and were selected. And these cells looked absolutely like iPS cells. They expressed, these are five different lines, they expressed the right markers. They had demethylated the endogenous OCT4 and NANOC locus. This would be the ES cell control. There would be fibroblasts. This would be B cells. And here are the BIPS cells, three different ones. And they could make nice chimeras and make germline contributions. So they were clearly iPS cells, which I think settles very clearly the issue, can you in vitro differentiated cells? One issue was really interesting was, what is the efficiency of this? By nuclear transfer, B and T cells were extremely inefficient. So what's the efficiency here? And we thought, and efficiency experiments with fibroblasts, Yamanaka's experiments and ours, were difficult. There was a lot of assumptions had to go into this, which were difficult to really rationalize. So we thought we'd make it very carefully here. And so the efficiency was done the following way. So we took, again, a primary chimeric spleen and isolate now the B cells from those. Now, this, you would get host B cells, which don't have the factors. You get B cells, which have the doxycycline factors. Then we infect this population with the CABP virus, which has a neo marker. And, of course, these transgenic cells have a pure marker. And the host cells have nothing. So then we infect those, we culture those, we seed them on 96 cell plates, because there are three types of cells. There are cells, host cells, which have no marker. There are these cells, which have not the MSV CEB alpha marker. And then there are ones which we want, which have those. So they grow all fine together. And now we grow them on OP9 cells. So we have the cytokines and all the goodies. And then after a few days, we select them now to double puro and neo selection. So this eliminates these cells, and these cells only leaves those cells which come from the transgenics and were infected. So we know exactly this is the population of cells which had the markers in this. And we asked the question, what's the efficiency? How many do we get? And it was amazing. We're getting 1 in 30 cells. So there's about more than an order of magnitude higher than any estimates have been done with fibroblasts. But I think we could do this experiment in a much more defined way. So I think it's rather efficient, actually, 1 in 30 cells of mature cells. So the reprogramming of mature B cells, the iPS cells had heavy and light chain rearrangements. They have somatic mutations. So CB-alpha probably induces B cells maybe to de-differentiate to some other stage, and then they become susceptible to these reprogramming factors, and they could make chimeras and germline contributions, and the efficiency is about 1 in 30, so pretty high. So when we think about applications, of course, there are two applications. One is to study complex diseases in the test tube, and the other one would be therapy. Now, I think this is a given, and probably everybody's aware of the enormous potential, particularly after the human cells have been isolated. And the idea would be you would take a biopsy from some patient with a complex disease, you generate these patient-specific iPS cells, and now you have genetically matched cells which you can in vitro study. And I think clearly the potential is enormous when you compare now, let's say, if you take an ALS patient as an example, you get ALS-specific ES cells or iPS cells, and from a normal individual, then you can ask the question, when you differentiate those, do you find a phenotype in vitro? And there's very good progress from Kevin Egger's laboratory that indeed he does find difference in the mouse model, depending on the glia cells from the mutants are important for this. And if you do find one, then you can ask the question, what are the markers for this? And do they correspond to the in vivo situation? And if you find a phenotype, then of course that would be very exciting because now you can use this to screen for chemicals which will slow or prevent whatever phenotype you see. And this could be the first, I think, logic way to develop a therapy. So there's enormous potential. This can be done with any line, patient-specific line, which is being developed now. It doesn't matter how many viruses they carry and whatever. This is there's no concern. It would be very informative. So I think that probably these cells probably exist already and people do this. So customized therapy, is that possible with iPS cells? And I told you before, the nuclear transfer, it worked. So there are, of course, a number of issues which we have to resolve. At the moment, we're using retrovirus and oncogenes. So these cells are highly genetically altered, and of course there's a risk for insertion mutations and cancer. 15 proviruses. You select for some rare event, that's obviously something which is a problem potentially. And tumors, of course, arise in all of these, or many of these iPS-derived cells. So Yamanaka's group reported 20% or so of his F1 mice got multiple tumors. We find it in our chimeras. Many, half of them get multiple tumors. And so you see that here, the survival curve, and they have really huge tumors, liver tumors, whatever. And when you look at this, why, it is in general the activation of the MYC virus. So MYC is, of course, it would be surprising as a retrovirologist if you have a MYC virus, you wouldn't get a tumor. Of course you get a tumor. So it's pretty crucial to replace the use of the retrovirus and the oncogenes. So can you reprogram without CMYC? And so we compared four-factor transduction with three-factor transduction. Can you do it without MYC? Would you get neo-resistant colonies? This case carried a neo or NOC, in the NANOC or the OCT4. And when you do this, with four factors, of course, you get a lot of colonies. With three factors, never. But, of course, selection was done at day six. That's what I told you, when you get the first neo-resistant colonies. So then Marius Wernick in my lab who did this, well, he just didn't do any selection. He just cultivated the cells. And at day 9, at day 11, the three factors, but just fibroblasts. With four factors, you have these colonies, these ugly colonies yet. But after 4 weeks, you see colonies coming up. And when you look at these colonies later, these colonies then make subsequently clearly iPS colonies, and they are neo-resistant. So when you look at this, it was clear. This is a very delayed process. Many fewer, maybe 10 or 20-fold less colonies you get, and some of those come up after 1 month, the earliest, some only after 2 months, and some never. Oh, well, I mean, obviously, it's a few cells to do it, so most never. So these cells are perfectly fine. iPS cells, they look like iPS cells, and they can make other mice and so on and so forth. So the conclusion would be, you can derive iPS cells without MYC. And this is from our group and from Yamanaka. You got identical results on this. So clearly, MYC accelerates the process and makes it much more efficient. But you can do without. And the issue is, of course, can you replace the other factors? And we can talk later about this, what would be involved. So how about therapy? And I want to talk about two experiments we did. One is sickle cell anemia, the other one is a Parkinson's a disease model. So in the sickle cell, is it useful for this? And so let me just remind you. A sickle cell is a mutation in the hemoglobin, and you have these sickle cells in the periphery, and they tend to clog up small vessels. And so you get brain and splenic infarcts. They're severe anemic because these cells lyse. They have compensatory red blood cell production. renal concentration defects and overall very poor health. So it's a really very serious disease. And a model for sickle cell anemia was produced by a double knockout of the mice of the mouse globin genes and a knock-in of the human beta sickle or the alpha globin genes. And these mice really have in their periphery clearly their sickle, and when you look at their spleen, they have these infarcted spleens and they're really huge. And this mouse really resembles very much the human disease and was generated in Tim Towns' laboratory in Alabama. So that's what we used. So the experiment was then to take one of these sick mice, and you see this mice is very anemic and looks pretty unhappy, and these mice really are anemic, their weight loss, and they die early, and then take their skin cells, infect them with the four viruses, reprogram those, and actually one of the viruses was modified, C-Myc. So we generate then iPS cells from those, and the Myc virus was modified in a way there are two lock sites so we can remove it by transient expression of Cre. So we remove Myc, so at least get rid of the Myc problem in oncogenes, because after Myc had done its job to make these cells. And then these cells, we corrected the mutation, that was simple, and then they were differentiated to hematopoietic stem cells and transplanted into the mouse, and they really rescued the mouse in a quite surprising way. So let me give you a few data on this. So it was done by Jakob Hanna, who did also the B-cell experiments, by the way. So the first experiment he did was to look in these mice by PCR at the alleles. And, of course, in the non-transplanted mice, only the sickle cell allele was detected of the upper band here. But in the transplanted mice, in the blood, you can see in three mice, there was clearly the wild-type band, the alpha band there. But in the fibroblast from the ear, of course, there was only the sickle cell. So that was encouraging. And then he looked at the parameters, for example, the hemoglobin level. This would be in a heterozygous control mouse. This would be in a sickle mouse. It's highly reduced. This would be before transplantation in one of those mice, and this after transplantation. It almost restored the hemoglobin to normal. And if you look at the hematocrit, it's very similar. So almost restoration in 4 weeks to the normal parameter. And if you look at the globins produced, this would be now a homozygous HB-alpha mouse. This would be a heterozygous mouse. You have almost a smaller sickle peak over the other one because there's probably selection against these cells somewhat against this globin expression. This would be the sickle mice. They have only 100% is the sickle hemoglobin. And this would be now these mice after transplantation. And you can see that they really restore almost to the level you find in the heterozygous controls. It's a little bit less because these are partially irradiated mice, so there clearly is still bone marrow which has a sickle cell, produce sickle cell, homozygous sickle cell cells, so you see the fraction of HBS in the periphery higher than in the heterozygous. But it's very stable, after 4 months so far. And when you look at their blood values, this would be now again the blood value of the sickle mice. As I said, the hemoglobin is about half, red blood count is really low, hematocrit is low, the reticulocyte count is very high because this bone marrow cranks out hematopoiesis, and the weight, they have enormous weight loss, but these mice, either 8 or 12 weeks after transplantation, you can see the hemoglobin is almost restored to the normal levels, red blood counts goes up dramatically, hematocrit is 90% of the normal. The reticulocyte count goes dramatically down, not totally. The bone marrow is still stimulated, and they gain weight, and they live so far happily. They haven't gotten a tumor. So I think this is really a much more realistic model for treatment in humans of bone marrow diseases than the nuclear transfer experiment I said before. I think the issue to translate this to the human would be, let's say for sickle cell anemia, it's not that you can't go through these steps. That, I think, is no problem. And probably going from here to here might be also solvable. But the problem at the moment is this step here, the correction, because homologous recombination is just not working very well in human ES cells. I think that's something which we really have to put a lot of efforts in. It's a technical issue. So I would think probably leukemia might be the very first application in humans because you don't have to modify the cells. You can just use the skin cells. Of course, there would be, they wouldn't have the mutation, which led to the leukemia. So that might be the very first application. But can you use it for other diseases? And of course, one of the issues people talk a lot about is Parkinson's disease, where you would then take cells derived from a patient, generate these iPS cells, and then transplant them into the right place in the brain. And this has been, of course, in clinical trials documented that this can help and restore the movement disorder to a certain extent. So we wanted to see whether it works, and the experiment was then to take iPS cells, make embryonic bodies, using really a protocol which is established by people like Ron McKay, Oliver Bristol, Ian Smith. So we're using this and generating neural precursors, and from those you can generate neurons and glia, and it works fine. You get from these cells, you get cells, and I'm not going to dwell into much here. You get the right markers in culture, and you get, in our hands, 5 to 10% of Th-positive cells, not many more. But I think some other protocols make more. We haven't been able. But anyway, that's what we got. And then we wanted to know how functional are these cells in an in vivo setting. And for this, we injected those cells into the E13 embryo, into the ventricle in utero, and asked the question. They were GFP labeled. You see these are the labeled cells. They were GFP labeled. We could ask the question, what happens now with these cells in the adult? Okay. And when we look at these mice, then we find in the adult, in various regions of the brain, midbrain, hypothalamus, septum, we find really these green cells, and they look like astroglia, they look like neurons. And when we look where they integrate, we find quite good integration in the midbrain, the hypothalamus, the striatum, more than 50 cells in these experiments, then the olfactory bulb, fewer, and then other regions of the brain, fewer. So you can establish these cells, and you can ask the question, are they functional? So for this, and you see here, these cells, they're this GFP labeling, they have spines, and they look really like neurons, they express markers. But the question was, since they were labeled, are they electrically integrated? And they are. So you can take these cells in acute brain slices and puncture them with electrode, and you see they clearly have spontaneous depolarizations. Really, they're in contact with other neurons, and you can inject currents into those and depolarize them. And if you depolarize them to a certain extent, like here, 38, or then to, you can probably read it, to more, then you clearly see they invoke depolarization and activation of these neurons. So they seem to be really functional and integrated. So then the question was, can they be used in a Parkinson model? And the Parkinson model we used is a rat. The rat model, which is used by many, I don't think is the best model, but that's what's available. And the question was, can you rescue this? And the model is that you unilaterally lesion these animals by six hydroxy dopamine injection to the medial forebrain bundle. And then you wait for 4 weeks, and then you give an amphetamine injection. And that really, since only in only one side, these animals begin to turn and they spin, right? And then the question is, when you inject now in the lesion site your test cells, is there a functional recovery? So do they turn less or whatever, or even they turn the other way around? So that's what the model. And I'm not going to go through to any of the details here, just show you that indeed you can. So in this case, after 4 weeks after injection, in 4 out of 5 rats, there clearly was some improvement. And after 8 weeks, I mean, in this case, 4 out of 4 animals showed improvement if you just use now the rotations per 90 minutes as a marker. And when we then look at these mice in the brains, they indeed have integrated dopaminergic donor-derived cells in the region, so as has been published by others. So I think the conclusions would be that most ES cells-derived neurons can functionally integrate into the developing mouse brain. That's an important conclusion. And the therapeutic potential of the reprogrammed fibroblasts is equivalent to that of ES cells, and as has been shown in other models. So clearly, I think the conclusion would be, certainly by these two models, iPS and ES cells really have the same potential. in terms of differentiation in therapy. So when we think about a strategy for cell-based therapy, then clearly what you eventually want to do is take cells from a patient and generate the customized cells for therapy, but not involving complicated issues like nuclear transplantation. So you want to take skin cells, get reprogrammed ES cells or iPS cells, and differentiate, and everything has to be done in vitro, of course. Now, this is an old slide. I used it many years. A couple of years ago, I thought, well, I mean, this one, would far away, we have to learn how the egg does and all this stuff. And it seemed to be just good to write in your grant, right, and make it interesting. But I think we're now, but you didn't believe in it. But I think now it really has become much, much closer to reality. We really can think about, I believe this step is more or less solved. I mean, it's really not technical. We have to do it without viruses. We have to replace the viruses and the oncogenes. I think this will be sooner than later, sooner than we think this will be solved, because so many people work on this now. And after all, these viruses or these genes only activate some signaling pathways, which one has to activate by non-genetic means. So I think that is the easy part. This is probably more the part which is more complicated. People work for 10 years already on this, and many functional cells, particularly in human, are not easy to make, or not at all, not satisfyingly. So I think there's much work has to go into this, and we need a lot of efforts, I think, to make this reality. But I think we're much closer to reality after this problem has been solved in a way than we were maybe 2 years ago. So with this, I want to acknowledge the people who did this. In my laboratory, was really worked by some of terrific people. Alex Meissner, Marius Wernick were involved really much in the early work, and Marius did all the Parkinson experiments and many of the other experiments. Toby Brumbrick, Ruth Forman, a student. Jakob Hanna, supposedly who did the sickle cell anemia experiment as well as the B-cell experiment. He's only for 9 months in my lab so far, but he did all this. Grant Volstead, John Cassardi, Frank Salzner, all those contributed in many, many ways. We collaborated a lot with Rick Young's lab. I didn't talk much about the circuitry. It's very involved in projects, and Laurie Boyer was the one who drove this from my laboratory, but she has now her own lab at MIT. And we collaborated on the Parkinson experiment with the laboratory of Martha Considine Patton. She's in McGovern Institute at MIT and her postdoc, and on the rat model with Ole Isaacson from McLean's Hospital with his postdocs, and with Tim Tones. He supplied us with these sickle cell mice. Thank you.
Excellent talk. You looked at when you showed the sequential activation of the pluripotency genes, did you also look at the sequential silencing of the of the genes responsible for differentiated phenotype? And did any of these intermediate stages reminded you of progenitors, tissue-specific progenitors?
So, I mean, the first question, we didn't look at this, but Konrad Hoelinger did, and he looked at Thy1 as being expressed on fibroblasts, and this gets inactivated sort of with the same kinetics as the SSA1 appears. Sort of, it's really what you would predict. Now, how these cells look like, that's very difficult to answer. So you look at these colonies. The colonies look like transformed ugly cells, but they would revert to fibroblasts if you withdraw the factors before day 12 in our system, right? And only a few cells of those make it to iPS cells. So they're very heterogeneous. These neoresistant colonies at day 10, very heterogeneous. The SSA1 cells are very, I showed you some of those. They're very, so we don't know whether, the problem is to get, the question really is, are there stable intermediates?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I showed you some data, SSA1 positive cells revert back, right? Mm-hmm. And if there are the few which have made it, whatever the stochastic events are, they go on. So I think it could be, so can you arrest this process?
Yeah, can you catch them in it?
Can you catch it?
Yeah.
And so this is interesting. Yamanaka's original paper, the FBFOX 15 cells, looked like an intermediate stage. So they were pluripotent by some assay. They could make teratomas. That's all they could do. They had not activated the endogenous OCT4. They had not reprogrammed the endogenous OCT4 and NOC. They were not demethylated. The virus was still expressed. So their differentiation potential was, of course, jeopardized by this and less. So this could be an intermediate stage. But why would this be? Why wouldn't they go on if I say that's a default state? It's something I don't understand. And so I think that's an interesting question, which I don't think I have an answer to.
So I have a question about the circuitry. There's emerging evidence from knockout experiments and other experiments that microRNAs such as miR-155 play a role in B-cell development, and other microRNAs play a role in control of DNA methyl transferases. So what role, if any, do microRNAs have in the epigenetic control of reprogramming?
I think there will be important roles. And we haven't defined those yet, but many people do. And clearly there is some microRNAs which get activated by these OCT4s and stuff like that. So I think this integrates into this, but I don't think someone has yet found one which really does a job, at least not to my knowledge. But many people can screen this, and we're doing this too, and we haven't really hit this. But I'm pretty convinced they will have a role to assist that. Yes.
Could I ask you to comment on two things? So one is in the CEPP alpha experiment, where you say it's very efficient. Isn't that a sort of similar experiment to the experiment you and Conrad did before in the gut, where you activate OCT4? And, I mean, actually it looks like you can quite efficiently move tissues, activate something, right? And in the case of the B cell, I mean, is this similar to the question Nadia asked. Is it like a hematopoietic stem cell?
So Ron is referring to an experiment we did because many years ago, predating the Yamanaka experiment, we thought, well, we express OCT4 and NOC, these genes, in this adult cells, and the way we want to do it by just giving doxycycline to a transgenic mouse and turn it on. So we made an OCT4 mouse, where you just give doxycycline and then express OCT4 in all tissues. And these mice died within 5 days. They died very interesting. They activated all their progenitors in the gut, and they filled the gut up with progenitor cells, and these mice could not absorb any water, and they just died. And you stop doxycycline, they immediately stop dividing these cells, differentiate, and the mice survived. It's a very powerful oncogene for these things. So we thought, of course, immediately we did that. We tried to make iPS cells from these guts. So if you put the marker in, Neo or whatever, we get them in 3 days. But when you take doxycycline away, they immediately revert back. We never could get a cell out of those. It's very, very surprising to us. So Yamanaka got them from these epithelial cells from the stomach. So we cannot do that. So it's very strange. So what I think is possibly happening is in this gut system, when we activate OCT4 from the endogenous locus, so the OCT4 is in an expression locus where you can induce it with doxycycline, you somehow don't force the endogenous circuitry to get activated. And you depend still on this. Somehow that doesn't work. Either tissue specific, something very surprising to us. So we didn't understand that.
Yeah, so there's another area where I think it'd be interesting for people to hear your thoughts, which is, I mean, what's special about the mouse system is that you can make mice. But actually, do you make mice all the time from these cells? Is there some variability here? Or?
So I think, yes, you make the mice from these iPS cells with a similar efficiency as for the ES cells. ES cells vary, right? And from these B cells, they're all made, most of them make chimeras, and we got germline contributions from, I think, 3 by now, but then we stopped testing. Some of these cells make these tetraploid complementation, which is the most stringent assay for pluripotency. We didn't get live mice from this yet. So I can't say you can make tetraploid postnatal animals, as you can with some ES cells, but it's not a very efficient process, so I think it might not, we have not tried enough. So to come back to your question, I think these cells are exactly like ES cells, except they have a longer history of culture and these retrovirus, and they probably have some genetic changes, some of those which interfere with this. So I don't think there's anything other thing special with there. I think sort of, as I said, it's weird to me, but it's a default pathway. You select for something culture. You select only for proliferation culture, nothing else. And as a side product, you get pluripotency, but you don't select for that. And so these are the fastest growing cells under your culture condition. That's why you see them. That's all what it's about. And you can induce it by nuclear transfer or by 4 factors or by 3 factors or maybe by no factor. I don't know, eventually, right? So by various means. I don't think there's a magic combination. OCT4 might be really important as being one of the most upstream genes we know. It's in the oocyte. It's a maternal gene. So to replace OCP4 might be the most difficult. SOX2 might be not that difficult because OCP4 can replace SOX2 in ES cells at least. And MYC we have already replaced, and KLF4 is sort of a little bit of a mystery gene, but clearly human cells, some cells, Jamie Thompson had done without it. So I think it says a lot of possibilities here.
You mentioned some instances of mouse tumors developing where retroviruses with c-MYC were used to transduce cells. I'm assuming that these were conventional retroviruses. Have similar observation been
Sorry?
Made? Have the similar observation, have the tumor development seen when lentiviral vectors were used for transduction? As you know, from little I know, my understanding is that from the experiment of Nature,
where 1 million people
are infected with HIV.
Right. We have seen also tumors and lentivirus coming. I mean, you would expect that. There's some breakthrough of these mechanisms, doxycycline and whatever. Yes, we have seen it, but maybe we haven't looked that carefully at this, so I can't give you a good comparison. I think removing MYC is probably the most problematic one of these four factors. But as Ron just mentioned, OCP4 is a powerful oncogene if you express it in the wrong cell in the adult. So you can't use OCP4 for patients, right? I mean, this would be from our experiments with mice. It's really as powerful as MYC, but it never appears in normal tumors. It's not an oncogene in normal humans because it's so well silenced, right?
Somewhat related to the previous question, you did touch on the safety issues that are obvious with respect to reprogrammed cells. How would you go about thinking about the comparison between products derived from reprogrammed cells and products derived from ES cells in terms of safety profile?
Well, I think, so let's say in the Parkinson experiment, the experience of people in the literature was, and we maybe looked at it, everybody get teratomas when you inject those in, all of them. And in our original experiments, all of the animals had within 6 weeks had teratomas. So what we did then was we sorted the cells. We sorted for SSA1 positive cells and through those, we sorted for SSA1 negative cells in these different, and then we didn't get any tumors anymore. So clearly, if you have undifferentiated cells when you transplant, that's a problem. So you have to, but this is a technical issue which I think is just really straightforward to resolve. You have to get rid of these cells. You can do it probably genetically, right, by selecting the right markers and killing the cells which you don't want. So I think that is probably solvable. And but this problem you see with normal ES cells, teratoma formation. So you see it with the iPS cells, of course, too. And then the iPS cells have the additional virus issue. That's, of course, you have to resolve.
I wish to ask a question regarding the 16 hours that you, from the injection of the virus to the reprogramming stage. How many cell cycles do you think the cell has gone through?
I think these cells begin, so that's clear. I think the role of these oncogenes is to really get cells going. So MYC is clearly an oncogene with KLF4, so KLF4 probably prevents cell death. And you overexpress MYC. And so I think MYC is really, it interacts with so many genes, 16,000 genes, right, it binds to. So probably MYC is, so how I see this, when the OCP4 locus replicates, that's the time when you can modify methylation, DNA methylation, histone modifications. And probably see MYC helps doing this. And then these exogenous factors can possibly interact with the endogenous genes. But sort of goes sequentially. That's what our model was. And MYC probably has a role of facilitating this. And that's when you don't use C-MYC, it takes much longer, 2 months. So I think these cells begin to grow fast, once a day or so. They're proliferate. So you get quite good proliferation.
Actually, my question is, does the reprogramming has to occur when the cells go through certain stage of the cell cycle? For example,
that's difficult to test because, I mean, you look at this proliferating population of cells, and I think if you interfere with proliferation, probably you stop the process. We haven't done that. And so this is not known. So, but I can't answer that question, really.
Thank you.